Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, on today's Leonard Lopate Show, some 4,000 prisoners escaped during last year's earthquake in Haiti. Leonard will take a look at a new documentary about the police effort to recapture them and also life in the tent cities where they hide. That's today at noon on 93.9 FM and AM 820 WNYC. Now, one of the early storylines as the WikiLeaks documents were published was that this dump would hamstring American diplomatic efforts around the world. United States ambassadors had egg on their faces, mostly because the secret back-channel communications that many suspected were happening ended up out in the open. But how much does the process of American diplomacy actually matter? It's a changing field. According to Parag Khanna, a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, countries are out in the 21st century, and cities and NGOs are in, he says, as world-building and world-stabilizing actors. That's according to his new book, How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. Khanna will be signing copies of his new book at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side on January 31st at 7 p.m., but right now he's here to talk with us about how mega diplomacy, as he calls it, can clarify our global uncertainty. Parag, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Mega diplomacy?
That's right. It's a shame that we have to add a sort of prefix to the term, but people have cast diplomacy aside. They say that it's over. They say that it's dead because of WikiLeaks. And this book is a reminder that it isn't. Diplomacy is, as the joke goes, the second oldest profession. It is as old as human history. It predates the states. It predates America. And it transcends governments. It's really anyone who forges transnational connections is a diplomat. Companies, NGOs, universities, humanitarians, churches. They all participate in their own diplomacy all over the world. And that goes back, again, since ancient times. And we're returning to a medieval-like period in which not only empires and cities and companies, but also states and other actors are getting involved in diplomacy. So when you hear about the Gates Foundation and Google having, you know, with their activities in Africa and China, they're engaged in diplomacy. They're engaged in making rules. They're engaged in changing policy. That is all diplomacy. Diplomacy is alive and well.
Leading to your theory that, to some degree, nation-states are on the way out.
Not necessarily. It's about the multi-layered nature of things. Yes, we have nation states, but we also have cities. New York City, where we are right now, Mike Bloomberg has a foreign policy. Look, New York City has its own intelligence services, its own climate policy, its own financial strategy, and cities are doing this. Companies are reaching out all over the world. They change the rules of investment in other countries. They do it on their own. Again, China and Google is a great example of a company facing diplomatic challenges. So all over the world, everywhere you look, rich countries, poor countries, you have this very diverse, multi-layered kind of situation.
And people are moving to cities or to metropolitan areas in unprecedented numbers all over the world. Do you see this as a good thing? Does this make you optimistic about the future?
This is definitely something that's inevitable. Urbanization is really a long-term trend that's been underway since before the 20th century and certainly through it and is now accelerating. And as you know, now more than half the world's population lives in cities. Generally, it's a good thing. Historically, cities are the drivers of innovation. They are also there's a lot of consumption in cities, but all of the efficiencies that come out of diminishing sort of our consumption of resources and so forth also emerge from cities eventually. So I think that in general, yes, it's a good thing.
Though what we see is a lot of people moving from rural subsistence farming kind of poverty to, you know, shantytown poverty in cities, on the outskirts of cities, seeking an industrial factory kind of middle class life. You know, again, this is not the United States primarily we're talking about, but all over the world, that for many, many, many of them don't actually exist.
What you're describing in terms of people moving from rural areas into cities seeking a factory job or something is certainly something that happens in China. But in other places, what's interesting is that in large mega cities, these sprawling third world places that are no doubt full of urban squalor, they're very stratified, just like medieval cities were. However, it's not just about getting a factory job. What you find in the slums, whether it's Mumbai or Jakarta, is actually thriving local economies, these self-sustaining ecosystems of small-scale service-like activity that in which people learn to provide for each other and create their own division of labor. So there's a lot of interesting things going on in these cities.
You write that political borders remain among the most fundamental obstacles to human progress. around the world. And you mentioned the EU as a successful ongoing experiment in mega diplomacy. Is that largely because the nation's borders or that region's borders, the EU's borders, are becoming porous?
Absolutely. This is one of the most undeniable features and trends in literally all of human history. It's the fact that the European Union has coalesced into a set of 27 and growing countries between which there is zero risk of war. And they fought many wars to get to the point where each nation, each tribe, in a way, has its own state. But now, because they have that security internally, they can now bring down those borders and deal with each other in a borderless way. And so what it takes, first of all, we just have to remember that, yes, it's true that we fight so many wars over borders today. People think of globalization, the borderless world. In fact, that's not really true. We have more countries than we've ever had before, and we still have to fundamentally remap some of them, and that's what's happening in Sudan this week because they're fighting over those borders.
Or now they were fighting over those borders, and now they're voting over those borders, and of course there's some violence around that too. Mm-hmm. But we also see the currency system, the euro, starting to be challenged because all these countries really have different economies, and we see what's happening in Greece and et cetera. And I can just hear them quaking, whoever's listening to the show in Arizona today, when you're talking about open borders, being the positive future.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the Mexico example, because if you look at the European Union relationship with Mexico, the European Union relationship with Turkey, which is a country that's fairly analogous to Mexico, they have had a customs union for 40 years. There's been tons of European investment into Turkey, so much remittance money from Turks who live in Europe, just like Mexicans live in the United States. No one would say that Turkey is nearly as volatile as Mexico is today. So what is the lesson? The Europeans have truly engaged economically and politically on all levels with Turkey and elevated it to a level where it's eventually going to be a candidate country for membership in the European Union. Today, no one thinks that of Mexico. It's because our strategy has been very one-dimensional and narrow. We can learn a lot from what's happened in Europe, despite the fact that they're having troubles with their currency right now. The European Union is above all a political project, not a monetary one.
So would you actually advocate not just a North American free trade agreement, but a North American political zone?
A North American Union is one term for it, and there have already been reports that have been published about this. Don't try and shoot down black helicopters right now, but it is it's very much something that should be considered, because without the kind of political engagement, and I don't mean political integration, political union, but political engagement to help to reform systems such as in Mexico and in Central America, we're always going to be trying to put up fences, and it's not going to work.
What would it take politically to get to the United States to the point where what you just said is even remotely a serious topic of political discussion?
Well, for one thing, we would have to prioritize Latin America as a whole. Every time a new administration comes in, they says, yes, we're going to take Latin America seriously. And George Bush even uttered his few words of Spanish. But then we get distracted by the Middle East or other sorts of crises. The fact is that for the United States to achieve energy self-sufficiency, even an industrial renaissance and its industrial base, it would really require refocusing our priorities towards Latin America and developing the economies of Latin America, using our commercial prowess also to build businesses in the region and bring manufacturing costs down. So a hemispheric partnership is the number one priority for the United States, but it always gets neglected.
In our last 35 seconds or so, we started with WikiLeaks. Do you think that a technology like WikiLeaks or the threat of leaks like that is going to effectively end old school diplomacy? Is that something you'd like to see?
Diplomacy always adapts. All WikiLeaks does is demonstrate how many different players there are in this diplomatic game that involves perception as much as it does reality. Now you have the United States going, sort of prosecuting a non-state entity called Anonymous, which is conducting the leak. So we have this. It just shows what a massive online multiplayer game diplomacy has become. And so you'll see more leaks. You'll see it affecting companies as well as governments, that we've just seen the beginning of it. It's neither a good nor a bad thing, but diplomacy always adapts to technology.
Parag Khanna is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. And if you want to hear more in person, he'll be signing copies of this book at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side on January 31st at 7 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.